Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. It's so good to be home. Sorry about the quality of the sound last week on my part. I was in a non-technologic zone called San Francisco, and the phone worked, but nothing else did. So anyway, I'm back, and it's been a strange week. I've been sick, and then the internet went down completely. The Cox line into this lane that I live down snapped, and phone, internet, and television all went out at once for all 9 residences in this little private lane. And it was the scariest thing you've ever seen in your life, because all we had left was conversation with one another.
That is scary. That's.
I mean, you know, the divorce lawyers were circling.
Did you immediately start trying to devour one another?
Yeah. Well, it was sort of like, I don't know, did you ever see Lord of the Flies?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. I was Piggy.
and you lost your specs. Oh, no.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay.
So well, anyway, I was going to say, I mentioned before we started the show, I know this is boring, but so I did a bucket list thing. I walked across the Golden Gate Bridge. I mentioned this to you, and I wanted just to share that if you're ever going to attempt that, be sure it is not during a period where one half of the walkway, because there's two of them, there's one on the west and one on the east side of the bridge. Make sure that you never try to walk across it when one of them is shut down, because what happens then is they blend the bicyclists and the pedestrians. And this is just just catastrophic, because I would say probably 25% of the people on bicycles are just learning to ride. And the guardrail is only maybe 4 feet high, 4.5 feet high. It's easy to fall over the thing.
Oh, gee.
And I was actually knocked against it once. And I had a terrifying second where I was grasping, trying to make sure I didn't get hurled over. And down below, you could see the white sharks. They were like koi in a fish pond, waiting to be fed. No, I think with the schedule of this thing. And I mean, it's just, what can you say about San Francisco? It's just the most beautiful thing imaginable, but it's just politically and Masonically crazed. I mean, the Masons run the place, and I mean, I don't know. It's, if it lasts another couple years, it'll surprise me. It's just the debts, but all of America's cities are basically in trouble, and the whole world is. And tonight, Tim, we're going to talk about the biggest dialectic of them all, at least in terms of the planet, the Cold War. I'm just fascinated by this idea of the Cold War. Can you help us understand it a little bit, get some background information? What is the Cold War?
The Cold War, well, some people have called it the Third World War. This wasn't a full-scale shooting war. Well, Wikipedia, all things Wikipedia, of course. Let's see what the standard narrative is. I read this, and this is pretty standard. The Cold War was a state of geopolitical tension after World War II between powers in the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet Union, and its satellite states, and the powers in the Western Bloc, the United States, its NATO allies, and others. Historians do not fully agree on the dates, but a common time frame is the period between 1947... the year the Truman Doctrine, a U.S. foreign policy pledging to aid nations threatened by Soviet expansionism, was announced, and either 1989, when communism fell in Eastern Europe, or 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed. The term "cold" is used because there is no large-scale fighting between the two sides, but they each supported major regional wars known as proxy wars. The first phase of the Cold War began in the first 2 years after the end of the Second World War. In 1945, the USSR consolidated its control over the states of Eastern Europe, while the United States began a strategy of global containment to challenge Soviet power, extending military and financial aid to countries of Western Europe, for example, supporting the anti-communist side in the Greek Civil War and creating the NATO alliance. The Berlin blockade, 1948 to 1949, was the first major crisis of the Cold War. With the victory of the communist side in the Chinese Civil War and the outbreak of the Korean War, the conflict expanded. The USSR and USA competed for influence in Latin America and the decolonizing states of Africa and Asia. The Hungarian Revolution of 1956 was stopped by the Soviets. The expansion and escalation sparked more crises, such as the Suez Crisis and the Berlin Crisis of 1961 and the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. By the 1970s, both sides had become interested in making allowances in order to create a more stable and predictable international system, ushering in a period of détente that saw strategic arms limitation talks and the U.S. opening relations with the People's Republic of China as a strategic counterweight to the Soviet Union. Détente collapsed at the end of the decade with the beginning of the Soviet-Afghan War in 1979. The early 1980s were another period of elevated tension, with the Soviet downing of KL-007 in 1983 and Able Archer NATO military exercises in 1983. The United States increased diplomatic, military, and economic pressures on the Soviet Union at a time when the communist state was already suffering from economic stagnation. On June 12, 1982, a million protesters gathered in Central Park, New York, to call for an end to the Cold War arms race and nuclear weapons in particular. In the mid-1980s, the new Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, introduced the liberalizing reforms of perestroika and glasnost and ended the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan. Pressures for national independence grew stronger in Eastern Europe, especially Poland. Gorbachev, meanwhile, refused to use Soviet troops to bolster the faltering Warsaw Pact, as had occurred in the past. The result in 1989 was a wave of revolutions that peacefully, with the exception of the Romanian Revolution, overthrew all the communist regimes of Central and Eastern Europe. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union lost control and was banned following an abortive coup attempt in August 1991. This, in turn, led to the formal dissolution of the USSR in December 1991 and the collapse of the communist regimes in other countries such as Mongolia, Cambodia, South Yemen. The United States remained as the world's only superpower. So that's kind of like the Cold War, the standard narrative sort of summarized. Of course, many people look at 1946 as a key moment. That was in February 1946 when the U.S. Treasury Department asked the U.S. Embassy in Moscow to explain why the Soviets weren't supporting the creation of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. In response, George Kennan, a U.S. Chargé d'Affaires in Moscow, wrote what's called the Long Telegram, signing Mr. X. This was published later in Foreign Affairs as the, I believe it was conducted as a longer article called the conduct of Soviet or the source of Soviet conduct in the world. And this is, of course, the Foreign Affairs is the publication of the Council for Foreign Relations, and in it he called for containment and said the Soviet Union is irredeemably aggressive and expansionist, needed to be contained by a global strategy of the employed by the United States. Basically, NATO or going into whatever they're pressuring, whatever they're expanding, going to counterweight it, that expansion. So that this was kind of the guiding philosophy of the Cold War up until its end, really, in the 1980s. So that's pretty much a summation of it. That's the official narrative of the Cold War. There's much more to it and more intrigue and perhaps... It wasn't quite the, you know, this Manichaean struggle that we've been told it was. It's much more complicated and convoluted. So, Joe, what do you have to say?
Well, you'll probably be shocked to learn that I think the Cold War is completely fake. It doesn't. So I stay consistent, don't I? At least with my ideas. It's like, yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that the oligarchs use to control us, the you know, propaganda 101 is the dialectic. You know, we talked last week about Ginsburg and the juxtaposition to Kavanaugh, you know. So you've got a struggle, right, between these two political entities and Supreme Court justices now. And they're set up to look like opposite sides of a political perspective, and people root for one and hate the other, but it's just fake, and it's completely fake. In this instance, you can, you know, I think we went through it pretty well last week, where we can just show that Ginsburg is not a real person. She's a lifetime actor. She's just set up to create the hatred or the love, you know, right? The two things that they have to have, you know, Donald or Hillary, Kavanaugh or Ginsburg. This stuff is just how they're able to give the impression that there is something that, you know, you can basically root for. So the political system in the United States is basically like, you know, the NFL or, you know, WWF. I mean, it's just World Federation Wrestling, you know. I mean, there's nothing real to it. The oligarchs create drama so that we don't see that the strings lead right up to them. And the Federal Reserve and, you know, the control over the military and the secret societies that rule us. So when you look at the Cold War, I would say that, you know, you have to believe in it. You have to think that in 1946, you know, that basically the Bolshevik system made some kind of dramatic transition. Because if you look at the Bolsheviks, you know, prior to that, if you go like from 1919 forward, I mean, it isn't very difficult to see that the Bolsheviks are basically, you know, there's two groups that you can see. I mean, one is Jews and the other is Masons. There are a few other people. There are always a few other people. You know, just to digress, if you look at the Frankfurt School, they're 100% Jewish except for this guy, Gramsci. A weird guy. He's the one who actually coined the term, you know, the long march through the institutions. And they have these kinds of individuals because then, you know, if it was all Jewish guys, then there would be, like, people would question if there's an ethnic component, you know, that's occurring here. But no, there can't be because you've got this guy, Gramsci, though oddly enough, he was the one who ended up in prison where he died. Mussolini got him. Where the other people in the Frankfurt School ended up in the Pacific Palisades with movie contracts. So I don't know. It just looks all kind of weird to me. But the Bolsheviks, I think are, you know, it's just basically an ethnic struggle focused on genocide. And you need, in order to pull off things like the Gulag, the Holodomor, right? You know, the different components of population reduction, you got to have some kind of dialectic. You can't just tell the people you're there to slaughter them. So you have, you know, the idea of that there's some kind of struggle, something good is in the future that justifies all of the slaughter today. And so we have the Cold War, and what does it really justify? Well, what we are in the process of developing is a technological slave state. I was just watching today this video of a robot that is, it's the most agile thing you've ever seen in your life. It can jump on boxes, you know, and it can run upstairs. You can hurl bowling balls at it, and it just can't, you know, ever be knocked down. And you look at something like that, and you go, well, who's going to control it? Who will have control over this technology? Because you can see that once the technology reaches a certain point, and at the same time the population is being dumbed down, you know, gets basically mentally diminished, then you will have a perpetual slave state. So I think that when I look at the Cold War, Tim, what I think is of the dialectic justification that was given to Western world as to why the governments were spending all this money developing basically what amounts to slave technology, you know, highly sophisticated planes and robots. And now, of course, you know, they have snooping control with all the whole internet is something that they have access to. So to me, the first way to look at the Cold War is to try to understand its origins, you know, and by that, I mean the origins of the people who are in control. In the United States, I don't think there's any question, but, you know, it's a secret society running the show. And in Russia, you know, which is the Soviet Union, you know, during in terms of political power during this period, it is once again we have a cold, you know, we just have a secret society that's basically running everything. And I think that, you know, when you start to go through the history of the Soviet Union up to the point where it you know, basically goes out of existence, I really don't think there's any, to me, there isn't, you know, much that is anything that isn't just completely consistent with, you know, the transition, like in the Hungarian Soviet from the reign of terror of Bela Kun and Gregor Lukos, and then they switch gears, and then you end up, you know, with the Frankfurt Society and cultural Marxism. Well, I think that's really the transition that kind of took place in sort of intellectually within the Soviet Union. You had the Reign of Terror period, and then when they made the transition intellectually, they, you know, you had Perestroika and this idea that there was going to be a more democratic Russia. But look what happens. I mean, you just immediately transition into an oligarchy. You know, from Yeltsin forward, you don't have anything that looks even remotely, you know, like the formation of democratic society. It's just everything is stolen, stripped down. A friend of mine is Russian, and he goes back every year to visit his family. And he's a good friend. He lives fairly close to me. And I asked him to describe the culture, and he says it's two-tiered. He says you have the large-scale oligarchs that control the military and the police, and they are basically kind of a billionaire class. You know, they're mysterious, but they have a different lifestyle. He says then in the common person, he says you have a lot of gangsters, and there's a lot of criminality and violence, but there is a partition between the two worlds. And he says that the people have simply given up. He says they don't really, you know, have any aspirations to do anything other than, you know, try to eke out an existence. The Cold War was, you know, it was just a distraction, and it was a period when the governments were able to transition into technological, you know, control over the population. And I think as they are able to ratchet up the technology, they can basically cool off the Cold War. They can look for other kinds of things to fool people with. I mean, what do you think, Tim? Does that make any sense at all to you?
Yeah, it became of course, the pretext or the justification for the national security state and perpetual war, or at least war preparedness, which is just huge, you know, perennial military budgets, central intelligence, secret agencies, these things, a permanent, secret, you know, agencies, classified agencies that have no real accountability to the public because everything's classified. It became that. This is like when William F. Buckley wrote in Commonweal in 1952 or 53, when he was dealing with some of the hesitancy of elements of the old right about the Cold War, he said, writing for the right, for the conservative, for the establishment conservative community, I guess you could say, that we must accept central intelligence, big government, big military budgets, and secrecy, even with Mr. Truman as in charge of it, meaning a Democrat. So that was more or less his vision of the future. See, this is just the way it is. It's circumstances. It's our government responding to circumstances, as opposed to these circumstances or conditions, you know, being created. Of course, one researcher who looked into this in the 60s and 70s was Anthony Sutton, who through his research primarily at the Hoover Institute uncovered evidence of going way back even to the Bolshevik Revolution of the Bolsheviks, communists being supported by Western bankers, the Warburg family, the Schiff family, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, that crowd, and what he uncovered in his research was this support continued, one degree or another, all throughout the existence of the Soviet Union, and that's what he wrote. I think it was 1968. He wrote Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, saying how key infusions of technology and also money was necessary for the perpetuation and growth of the Soviet Union in the 20th century, thus creating the enemy that the national security state needed to justify its existence. And he did other things. He did other books like Wall Street and The Rise of Hitler. And so what he really uncovered was that the Hitler, Stalin, and the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, these foreign enemies are more or less created by the West to justify perpetual war. It's a strategy. It's a global, it's a strategy of tension writ large globally to justify all the things that you talked about, the perpetual national security state. With that, I mean, you have this. And what he said, you mentioned secret society, and he came in the course of his research, he came across Skull and Bones in all of this. Of course,
what a shock!
Yeah,
what a shock!
And basically, to say this multi-generational foreign-based secret society had sort of inveigled itself or gotten control of the government and corporations and these things. They kind of had their fingers in every pie, And so, this was, I think, revealed to him. Someone gave him a membership book bound in leather. It turns out it might have been Charlotte Isherby Thompson who gave him. Her father was a member of Skull and Bones, and he was ailing, and an old man gave her this book, and then she reportedly loaned it to Anthony Sutton to do his research on fleshing out on his book on Skull and Bones, The Order. He wrote a book on Skull and Bones as well. The importance of the secret society. But like I said, if you look at these things, with the war, not just the Cold War, even the Second World War, it wasn't just Sutton, also this guy Charles Higham wrote a book called Trading with the Enemy, exposing World War II, how even during World War II, Standard Oil was facilitating the supply of aviation fuel to the Third Reich. During the war, Ford Motor Company was building trucks and vehicles for the German army. Even the Third Reich itself was transporting fuel to the enemy. I think one of the members of the board of IT&T was an SS colonel receiving a check throughout the war. Paycheck. You know, so these business interests perdured continued throughout the war. People have exposed things like, the Bush family and the Union Bank working with German industrialists throughout the war and these things. Now, you could say these things are just business interests and all things, and maybe they are, but so was the war. The war was just a business. And what does war do, whether cold or hot? It's good for business, and it's good for creating destruction and chaos and out of order chaos. And out of the chaos of the Second World War and the Cold War, you get, of course, the unipolar world, the New World Order that they're trying to get. But if anything, what war is good for doing, it's good for creating new organizations or justifications for things like the IMF and the World Bank. Bank of International Settlements was created after World War I to handle reparation payments from Germany. It still exists today. United Nations and these things, the European Union, the World Trade Organization, and these things all dedicated to globalism, one worldism, and these things. So that's what that's what these wars are all for, and that's what you talk about. The slave state is this technological system that they've developed. People talk about even the internet itself that we're using today. Ostensibly, it was created to maintain communication in the event of a nuclear war.
Exactly. Hyper-text transfer protocol. I mean, that's exactly what that means. It was the idea that they could get important documents from one computer to another before the bomb hit it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the original ideas of it.
So yeah, it's a stage. Now, it doesn't mean at one level, when you say it's stage, it doesn't mean that real things didn't happen. It's like Second World War was sort of created, but doesn't mean there were real battles and cities weren't bombed and millions of people didn't perish. And the same thing with the Cold War, you had second tier or third tier participants or actors playing their role, and many I'm sure believe they were fighting the good fight on either side. And so you had spies and these things, and who thought they were fighting for their side in the Cold War. So you had a lot of intrigue, and out of this you get a lot of great espionage novels, right? There's a genre of literature and these things, and film, and it infects the culture. And that's one of the things what the oligarchs do is they change the culture with these things. And the Cold War became a culture. One interesting take on this is want to show the sort of the Cold War for the fraud that it was is a while back I interviewed Mark Hacker, and he's a Russian speaking academic, and he does a lot of translations of articles, and he actually translated an article about Victor Rothschild, who headed up British intelligence during the Second World War, very close to Winston Churchill, and also with the Cambridge Five. And in this article, he cites how there is a diary of a KGB colonel, I think Ivan Alexandrovich Sirov, who passed away in 1991. But in this diary, it exposes Victor Rothschild as being a spy for the Soviet Union. Now, in the article, the Sirov doesn't trust Rothschild. I mean, diaries, Sirov himself doesn't trust Rothschild. So he's playing a double game, meaning that maybe Sirov is seeing through him. That maybe Rothschild wasn't working for the Russians. He was controlling both sides, meaning he is also was apparently the handler of the Cambridge Five. At the same time, he was also manipulating the Soviets, being Rothschild, being this banking family. So one of the Rothschilds, and that's a good example right there. That I've interviewed Servando Gonzalez, who wrote a book called Psychological Warfare in the New World Order, and in that book he presents a strong case that Castro is kind of an actor. In fact, he was an actor. He has an IMDb page. And so he has times his theory that's in the final analysis, Castro was working for the Council on Foreign Relations, sort of creating that dialectic down there in Cuba.
Well, I mean, I've actually been to Cuba and spent quite a bit of time there. Great place to vacation, lovely people. If you go to Havana, it's very run down, but there's one really nice building that's just shocking, and it's the Masonic Lodge.
He didn't shut that down, huh?
No, I didn't shut that down. And in fact, it's the only building that has a fresh, well, it's not even a paint job. It's like, looks like it's brand new. The rest of Havana is like collapsing. But man, that is one beautiful city. If you ever get a chance to go there, it's a terrific place. But I've always thought that Castro was a lifetime actor. I think they all are. I mean, I think that basically sometime, between Palmerston and, 1840s and 50s was running what was called Palmerston's Zoo. Perhaps you've heard of that expression. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Masons had agents all over the planet. And they were basically able at that time, particularly since there was British expansionism going on and they had, military power everywhere and financial power, they were able to weasel away their way in one way or another into basically positions of political power everywhere. And I think perhaps, the Tsar was one of the last ones who was not in the guild. And, then they got rid of him. They then had pretty much control over all of the political system. And then you had, this basically a system, a series of kind of fictional events that were used to reduce population. They wanted to reduce the European population. And so if you just look at that the next 100 years, you get these absurd wars, mm-hmm. you have the starvations. It's just a catastrophe for the Europeans immediately after, Palmerston set his agents everywhere. And There is, as I've said, you know, many, many times, there is some, there are so many connections into Jewish organizations, Jewish individuals, that it makes me suspect that the Masonic half of this, you know, Anglicans like Palmerston actually view themselves in some way as Hebrews, and that they have some sort of ethnic concept that enables them to create secret societies with this class of Jews that is highly political, highly financial, and very murderous, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. If you look at the, you know, what goes on once these people get control of a country. Now, you know, one of the reasons why I think the Cold War is, you know, so obviously fake is that if you look at the transition from World War II into the Cold War, I mean, what really precipitates it? You know, the Soviets are actually fighting on our side. There's no particular tension between so-called capitalistic West and you know, godless communism Soviet Union, and they're working together. They're supposedly fighting against Hitler. There's cooperation. And somehow, mysteriously, kind of what sets off the dialectic, I don't know, you know, if you've followed or studied this, but it's the Soviets capturing the technology for the nuclear bomb. And I've often thought that the real reason that they developed it, and remember, you know, just to back up, the nuclear bomb was not something that American democracy participated in the creation of. This was a skull and bone project. I mean, it was a Bohemian Grove project, mm-hmm. which is now not even a conspiracy theory. That's Bohemian Grove is very proud of this fact. So you have to wonder, well, if this wasn't a political or democratic act, then what in the hell was the purpose of it? I mean, basically, it's just a terror weapon to work in conjunction with a false dialectic. That's what the thing is. That's what these bombs are. And that's why there's, you know, they had that secret base in Laurel Canyon that was supposedly involved with all this film footage. And I'm sure they were developing pornography. I mean, Marilyn Monroe was not a nuclear physicist, so there was something going on there beyond this. But I also think they were trying to figure out how to film the bomb in the best way in order to terrorize people. Because they were going to then use the threat of this nuclear war as the primary justification, well, primary confusing device for the public. See, I mean, it's not even a particularly complicated plot. It's just they wanted the public to be really scared because they were going to really ratchet up the technologic slave state. And they with the creation of the terror bomb and the giving of the technology to Soviet Union, because remember, it's if only the U.S. had this weapon, then there wouldn't be any reason, right, to be worried about it. Mm-hmm. In fact, just the opposite. You know, you would be very suspicious of politicians wanting to take away liberty because you would say, well, you know, we've got the bomb to defend ourselves. Why do we have to, like, you know, go into these slave camps every 6 months, whatever? So when the Soviet got the technology, then they could really go to town because now they had the justification for, you know, the so-called Cold War.
Yeah, the arms race.
Yeah, the arms race.
Well, it's interesting because according to Carol Quigley in Tragedy, when he wrote Tragedy and Hope, he cites the Manhattan Project, how scientists foresaw a nuclear arms race if this weapon was developed. So
it was sort of Oppenheimer or Teller?
Yeah. You know, I think Oppenheimer was a father.
They're on the, you know, I mean, where they're on the 33 degree position where they have these Masonic, they're all Masons and Jews. And then they call the site where they blow the bomb up Trinity.
Yep.
You know, because this is New World Order and the Christian world is now going to end because the terror weapon is now in existence.
Yeah, and the bomb wasn't so much created as a means of national security or war effort. It was more created to create a terror weapon in the aftermath of the Second World War. I mean, if you look at the, you mentioned Laurel Canyon, those films, and many people, some of those films appear to be kind of faked now.
Yeah.
So it was designed for public consumption, about what's the true nature of atomic weapons, these cells, because, theoretically, I can see how it works. And but outside Hiroshima and Nagasaki, none has never really been detonated or, weaponized, used as a weapon. Some people have speculated that maybe the claims of their destructive power are grossly exaggerated as a form of psychological warfare. I find that theory tantalizing. Also, I kind of like it because I like the idea of entertaining the notion, that idea of thermonuclear weapons that can destroy entire cities, entire continents, is just a psychological warfare, and indeed, humanity might not be destroyed in an afternoon. So I kind of like that theory, that it's kind
of
exaggerated.
I do too. I can't, of course, I don't have the physics chops to be able to vet it. But yeah. I will say that the bombs that were exploded at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were, just Cold War, instigators. And they were done just for propaganda. And I mean, by that, I mean to control the American public to accept the Cold War after the Second World War ended. I don't know, I think we've talked about the strategic bombing survey that was done following World War II, and it was very clear. I was actually looking at it the other day, and then, they're just clear as a bell. The Japanese were defeated. The U.S. would have lost zero troops to effect a surrender. Mm-hmm. The Japanese were trying to surrender. They were out of food. They had no weapons. There were no military targets. This idea that we would have lost a million men is just preposterous. So why would they drop the bombs off? And one of the Navy admirals, I think may have been Halsey, he said, well, it wasn't a military decision. It was the technical people just had this toy and they wanted to set it off. So in other words, it was a decision made outside of the military command. Mm-hmm. But this is just a dead giveaway that what this is it's just being done for terror. In other words, it isn't the Japanese weren't the target of the terror. I mean, obviously they surrendered, but that could have been affected, in 100 ways.
Oh, yeah. The conventional Tokyo firebomb rating actually was more destructive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Way more people. But the American people didn't understand that the actual target of the nuclear bombs was them.
Well, same with the Cold War, right? The actual target of propaganda was us.
Yeah, we were the ones who got blown up. I mean, our freedoms and our ability to function coherently, in terms of the
political duck and cover.
Yeah, I actually did that. That was like, you got to think how preposterous this is. I'm in fifth grade, and it was really traumatic because I had grown up in Japan. And I had people in my house, Japanese are made. I mean, her family was wiped out. I mean, this was like a really real thing in my life. And man, when they would say duck and cover, I would curl up in a fetal position as tight as a snail. I was really duck, don't let the bomb get me. I was scared. And
then the movies, right? Twilight Zone episodes with bomb shelters. You have, what was it, movie The Beach with Gregory Peck?
Yeah, well, On the Beach, that was a Masonic book, which is, just basically, a celebration of genocide. anyway, it's a little hard to decode. I won't waste people's time with that. But anyway, the thing is that...
Failsafe, remember that? Failsafe?
Yeah, Failsafe, yeah. Well, and Dr. Strange.
Well, Dr. Strange, of course, yeah.
was the ultimate, comic, sex, and terror. Mm-hmm. And so, this is like it's the agents of the Majesties, the 007 class are really sexy guys. It's a great lifestyle. They're fighting for us. And at the same time, the military budgets just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the military control. I mean, when I was in San Francisco last weekend, they had the Blue Angels. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is just militarism on a scale that's almost unimaginable. They took the entire sky above the city. Now, the acrobatics are just spectacular. But just think of the psychological effect
yes,
that it has.
Yeah.
The public is all there just, crouching down. The noise is just deafening. These things come right at the rooftop when they come out of their death spirals. And then as they ascend heavenward, they release a kind of chemtrail, red, white, and blue. The public is confused and also bedazzled, and so we're getting just like the Russians with the bifurcation. You know, you have the technology of the militarized oligarchs that run the political system. I mean, we just don't get it. We have nothing to do with it. Their technology, the technology of the government, is increasing dramatically in its control power. And the public, I mean, this is why they show us shows like, you know, Naked and Afraid and Dual Survivor, and, you know, they glamorize the post-electric world, because believe me, it's coming for the population of people who are not inside the secret society. That is what you're going to get pretty quick, is you'll have a post-electric world, and you'll be told this is a great idea because it's environmentally friendly, you know. But on the other side of the fence, you know, the bifurcation, they are not environmentally friendly. They are just doing whatever they want to the environment in order to make sure that their power is static and in place. And so, you know, we had the Cold War. The American public never woke up during the whole thing to the concept that it was fake. You know, they never got it. They just believed the Lifetime actors through the whole thing. You know, the fake Cuban Missile Crisis, the, you know, and that's why I think it's, see, and it's really valuable, I think, to really look at the original Politburo and how it gets set up and who they are and things. Because you can see that, well, this is clearly it is an organization of Masons and Jews. It's very ethnically oriented, right? If I, you know, I just, and but when does it transition? You know, I mean, in other words, if this is the reality of the Soviet Union, it's the secret society control, then are we to believe that, like, well, Gorbachev and Perestroika was actually something that transcended it? Because I'll tell you something. This is why, like, people look to Putin, you know, and they say, well, Putin, you know, he's battling against the Rothschild banking system. He kicked them out of Russia. Let me tell you something. If Putin was real, the first thing he would do would be to expose 9/11. In my opinion, the idea that that someone in that position would not make this a public fact is just ridiculous. At least it creates the suspicion that there is a transcendent organization that gives instructions to these people. Because I heard Putin talk about 9/11, and he went into a big deal saying it couldn't possibly be a conspiracy theory, and anyone who thought that didn't understand how modern intelligence services operated. That was his explanation. That forget the rules of physics, the intelligence service would expose it. But you see, this is just mind control, you know. And so I think that, unfortunately, I think that the world was carved up politically, some point in the 19th century. And what you've had ever since then is just a series of Lifetime actors and fake dialectics, and the Cold War, was the greatest one, the largest. It was covering the whole world, and now it's come back. But you know, I was going to say that when you understand the Cold War, you can really see 9/11 clearly, because that was the beginning of the hot war against the Islamic terrorists, right? So you had the Cold War, and that served its purpose of militarism and technologic development. But now it's the era of terrorism. You know, this was ushered in with 9/11, and it's basically the Greater Israel project on one level, because they are just coming up with excuse after excuse to kill Muslims. I was, the other day I got a statistic. I don't know if you've seen it. But someone has done a calculation, and he said there's been 30 million Muslims killed since 9/11. It seemed possible to me. I can't, you know, how can you vet this number? But this guy, he seemed credible, and he said, yeah, it's been that many. There's been a lot of people killed.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you're depopulating the region that in Deuteronomy, incidentally, we talked about that last week, you know, that it's outlined, right? This vast area, which just happens to more or less overlie the areas that the group that produced the Project for the New American Century said had to be, you know, full spectrum dominance somehow. This was going to be good for American foreign policy. But anyway, this it looks to me like what you have is a slow motion population genocide. They're just getting rid of everyone in this zone. And Israel simply will expand out into this area over the next 100 years as the other populations collapse. And so you have, you know, the Cold War was a, you know, an era. It was an episode in the process. And now even the vestige, you can kind of see where like Russia comes in, you know, and like is supposedly supporting the Syrians against, you know, whatever, you know, thing. But there isn't any even coherent explanation or rationale anymore for, you know, the Mideast wars. They just are basically wars of genocide. And this is the new terrorist boogie. Just the other day, they had American general, and he was talking about, I couldn't even remember what terrorist group he was talking about. It was Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, ISIS, but he had one of them, and he was talking about, and he was saying that they've had a resurgence, and he's very worried, you know, that they're going to regain control over some country. But he says, don't worry, we will respond with a rain of bombs. He used this expression, that's what stuck in my mind, and I was thinking, God, you know, we're going to rain bombs down on these people, just like we're going to get rid of the population, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah, and since when is that considered an effective strategy against terrorism? Because yeah. Obviously it's among the civilian population. But that, you know, that, I'm sure that'd be very expensive. That's good for Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics.
Oh yeah.
You know, but yeah, you with the late 70s, I think it was 1979, when you had terrorism conference in Jerusalem that was hosted by Benjamin Netanyahu. And I think George Bush was there, and this was sort of creating this environment going into the 80s as the Cold War was going to be phased out. They were going to usher in the age of terrorism as the excuse for yet another long war, as someone once called it, the long war against terrorism, where there isn't even a nation state that you're at war with. It's just this, you know, this this intangible terrorism. It's a strategy you're at war with. And you can, it's ever-changing characters. You can have Osama bin Laden, you can have someone else step into the role, play their role, different groups. We can rebrand terrorist groups, ISIS, you know, to Al-Qaeda, whatever. So it's a gift that keeps on giving. And, of course, I've talked about in other shows, is how these terrorist groups have been used as shock troops or proxy forces for NATO to destabilize regions at any given time, whether it's the Balkans and Yugoslavia, Serbia, and Kosovo in the 90s, or the Caucasus and Russia in the 90s into the 2000s, North Africa, Iran, and of course Syria. So these they can be used to destabilize and weaken countries. So that serves the Odan Yanan plan, the Greater Israel Project. Also at the same time, it leads to this migration crisis in Europe that can be used to disrupt these to destroy what remains of the ethno-European states.
They're just on the chopping block at this point. They're just getting slaughtered, and you're exactly right. They're just bringing in millions of these people, and it destabilizes the cultures that the Islamic males come from, mm-hmm. and they have what's happened to their culture. You know, it's just gone. It's just, you know, evaporated, and then where they end up, where they land, you know, that's just going to be a madhouse. Yeah. So
another thing about the Cold War was these arenas, these theaters of war, whether it's Vietnam, Central America, Afghanistan,
Korea.
Yeah. Well, if you look at it, it's a pretext to facilitate the international drug trade, because from the get-go, The international heroin trade was more or less given a wink and a nod by the OSS then CIA in the, right after the Second World War in Italy, when that was a deal that was struck between, it was called, you know, the Luciano Project, where he was released and allowed to go back to Italy, and he was more or less given the franchise there to ship heroin to the United States. Then coming from Turkey, it was called, you know, called the French Connection, as you know from the movie. But he was there to smash up communists, particularly in the unions there, and to facilitate the victory, I think, of the Christian Democrats in post-war Italy. So whenever you have these intelligence operations, like in Vietnam or in Nicaragua or El Salvador in the 1980s, you have a very lucrative drug trade, drug and arms trade going in and out of there. And so that's, again, another excuse for creating an entire underground economy. It's become much more, I think, important to the overall economies of the world is the, you know, we talk about the petrodollar, is the narco dollar, and how that's used to, you know, capitalize banks, and that creates vast distortions in the U.S. economy, anywhere from, you know, real estate purchases to, you know, sports teams, these things, and yeah, where it does, yeah, the culture. Certain corporations get access to that drug money in the term of cheap credit or capital, and this leads to the distortion or concentration, the corporatization of the U.S. economy and the destruction of small, mid-sized local businesses and these things. And the drug trade is a big part of that. So Skull and Bones, which, of course, itself was capitalized at first by the international opium trade, of course. That was, you know, the Russell Trust and the the clipper ships in the early 19th century, and this created a vast fortune, created a vast banking empire, which they leveraged to more or less gain control of the U.S. economy and ultimately the U.S. government. It's no surprise that, you know, you talk about the dialect of the Cold War, the sort of the fakeness of the Cold War, is you look at OSS in China, how OSS was there. At the same time, they were working with Chiang Kai-shek, they were also working with Mao Zedong. And he had an OSS handler throughout this period. And, of course, the opium trade played a big part in that. And so, but, you know, it's just, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's, but the, it's kind of funny because if you look at the you talk about the Cold War, let's just talk about its cultural effects. Of course, there's this book called The Cultural Cold War by Frances Stoner Saunders. And she talks about, you know, at the height of the Cold War, the U.S. U.S. government, particularly CIA, had committed vast resources to a secret program of cultural propaganda in the West, where they put a bunch of artists and writers on their payroll. They funded hundreds of magazines, academic journals, art. Who's to say? I mean, you can extrapolate from this, movies and these things. The problem is, and this was, of course, done on the pretext of sort of winning the intellectual, or getting intellectuals on the side of the West. So this became an excuse to, like, fund modern art and things like that.
Right. It's ludicrous. Yeah. I mean, it was obviously just done to create a debased culture.
Yeah, and a good example is, you have, you know, how sweeping this was, is that all in the Congress, you know, you have people like Tom Braden, who was a journalist and who was working for the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and who was the other, Ben Bradley. Was, yeah, an editor working for the CIA over there in Europe. And of course, he becomes editor of the Washington Post, which is a CIA paper. But this vast cultural propaganda program means that we don't, you know, we're supposed to live in a free society where you have, you know, sort of a pluralistic society where there's artists are free to think, writers can write what they want, publish in these things, these magazines. But if they're all being funded by the CIA and CIA-related foundations, the whole thing's controlled, and we don't know where it ends. And that's one of the examples, or one of the lessons we get from Operation Mockingbird. You know,
yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you've ever read it, but I did an analysis of Catcher in the Rye, mm-hmm. and you know, Salinger was OSS, mm-hmm. You know, World War II guy, and he writes this book, which is basically a cultural debasing book, right? And I don't think Salinger, until I did the analysis, and there's two different pieces. One is called The Freemason in the Rye, and the other is called The Pedophile in the Rye. Mm-hmm. And they look at two different aspects of the book. And I think that the analysis that is done in my little pieces is so clear, I just can't imagine any clear-minded person reading them and not agreeing. But what you end up with is, Salinger was never even pointed out as being basically a CIA shill, you know, in terms of his literature. He Everyone knows he worked for the OSS during World War II, but they always think he's some kind of curmudgeonly, you know, guy who had a weird thing for young girls. But he isn't actually listed as like a Mockingbird type, you know, asset. But my point is, if you look at the analysis, you can see he definitely was. He was both promoting Freemasonry, he was also trying to find a way to debase culture to promote pedophilia. Okay, so you have to then wonder, well, you know, well, what about like Ken Kesey, right? I mean, here he was an MKUltra employee. He comes up with this book, which is basically, you know, kind of promotes drug use, quasi freedom. After, you know, the world is crazy, and then he does the acid tests, you know, where LSD is given away to children. And
of course, MKUltra is justified by the Cold War.
The Cold War, but you see, the my point is just that. Look, when you look at Kesey and Salinger. You can see how deep the control over the arts is, because these aren't guys that you would normally think of as being in Operation Mockingbird. And yet when you do a review of the literature, you go, wait a second, these guys are 100%, you know, just, you know, crushing the kind of intellectual strength of the culture. They obviously are part of it. They're actually good to understand, because it shows that, you know, you have the Mockingbird types like Ben Bradley and, you know, all these, and Jackson Pollard, you know, the crazy art guy with the squiggles and stuff. But then even people that you wouldn't even imagine are inside it. And it makes you wonder, like, you know, and I don't have analysis to show this, but like people like Warhol, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the whole, everyone who basically is bubbled up through the media control, you have to wonder about. You really have to wonder just how fake all of that is, right?
Well, because, given the Rockefellers' fetish with modern art and the reason behind that, was sort of hatred of beauty and the aesthetic. Yeah. So it's kind of like, although the Rockefeller Foundation Nelson Rockefeller supporting is putting Jackson Pollock films upside down and Chase Manhattan Bank and no one's noticing. That in itself is a form of aesthetic warfare, which is an extension of this. Although it's not, may not be directed, you know, like you said it before, culture has its own momentum. You fund certain things, and if you're a sort of malevolent oligarch, you can destroy art just through your funding.
Yeah. I think Warhol gets some mysterious funding, and the next thing you know, people are looking at like soap boxes as great art.
Campbell soup cans or something.
Campbell soup can, right. Yeah. We're being told that this is something, I mean, what? How is this real? But that is how fragile culture is. You know?
Yeah, yeah. There's a book I read a while back. It's rather conventional, but it's very interesting. It's by Derek Liebart. It's called The 50-Year Wound, How America's Cold War Strategy Shapes Our World. He talks about the cultural effect, particularly Cold War and popular culture or art. And he is writing here... And he says, popular art had caught on to the curious backgrounds, peculiar methods, and frequent ineptness of America's secret operatives. In Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest, for example, suave ad man Cary Grant is mistaken for an agent working for the professor and his Washington colleagues. "I don't like the games you play, professor," exclaims the innocent, caught up in the double-edged tactics of something very much like the CIA. "War is hell, even when it's a cold one," responds the spymaster, unconvinced and appalled. Washington needs to ask girls like the patriotic Eve Marie Saint to bed down with the enemy. Grant tells the professor, "Perhaps you ought to start learning how to lose a few cold wars." The professor replies, "I'm afraid we're already doing that, Mr. Thornton. I think it's Thorndike in the movie. It's a misprint. I think it's Thorndike in the movie. But anyway, I thought that was a good way of capturing sort of the corruption of the Cold War itself. Obviously, the men at the top know what the game is, but obviously there are functionaries who are being seduced by the necessity of the Cold War and making all these moral compromises and sort of being very morally pragmatic and ruthless in this and justifying things like, you know, making girls bed down with the enemy or you know, fomenting civil wars here and there that results in the death and suffering of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, staging a coup here and there for the benefit of United Fruit or the Seven Sister Oil Companies. Of course, I'm talking about Iran and Guatemala, and these all done, again, under the context... in the context of the Cold War. And so I thought that was a good illustration of that in that book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting in that, you know, people have wondered about this, but, you know, in hindsight, it's just absolutely transparent, is that you have the funding from Montague Norman, but he's using, like, the Warburg family, which is just a cutout of the Rothschild, or at least of elite Jewish banking family, because they're completely interrelated, right? The Warburgs are not, like, some kind of, you know, dark sheep. I mean, they're inbreeding with the Schiffs and the Rothschilds. They own corporations together. And so they, when you see them directly related to the funding of the Nazi Party, right? Just absolutely point for point, directly related to it. And you have to understand.
We're controlling IG Farben.
Well, here's the point. You have to understand, they know perfectly well what is going to come out of the Nazi Party. Because when you start to break it down like we did when we did shows on the Nazi Party and see how obviously artificial it is, how the World War II was artificial, the people that are doing the funding, like the Schiffs and the Warburg, they know perfectly well what is going to happen as their funding comes to fruition with an enormous war machine in Germany that can be used to kill itself with. But you see, that's why it's so critical that there's evidence that like, for example, that the Schiffs and Kuhn and Loeb were funding the Bolsheviks. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't, for some reason, don't get how important that is, because this is the same family that was funding the Nazis. You see, now you wouldn't fund both sides, particularly if you know where the game is going, unless you have a motive that is ulterior to the ones that is, given to the public. So when you look at Jacob Schiff's $20 million into the Bolsheviks in I think it was in 1917, well, then the question, of course, is, well, he isn't doing it to try to help people, right? This is ludicrous. He's doing this to create political power, right? He's doing this to create control. What is the control used for? Well, what happens? What happens is hundreds of millions of Europeans dies. Mm-hmm. They all die, right? So now when you then transition from like the primitive Bolshevik era, where is the separation? You see, my point is, I don't see any point in time from 1917 to the present that there is any transition of political culture in the area that's, the Soviet Union was consisted of. I don't see anything at all. And so when you look at the origin of the thing, and I just want to take just 1 minute to give one of my this is my favorite laugh riot things about the Bolshevik Revolution. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it's exactly the same as, we talked about in the Hungarian Soviet, that you had guys like Bela Kun, but his real name was Kohn. Mm-hmm. You had Lukas, but his real name is Lowenstein. And you had there was like two or three other guys. And they all have, it's like I said, it's like a young Frankenstein. And every one of them has a fake name. But think about the Politburo in 1917. You had Trotsky, but his real name is Bronstein. Mm-hmm. You had Zinoff, but his real name is Applebaum. You have Lauren, but his real name is Loria. Yeah, I mean, it just goes on and on. There's like eight guys in there who are Jewish that have fake names. And then, of course, you got Lenin, but his real name is Uldenov, I think. And who knows about him?
I think he was quarter Jewish. Because,
well, that's the thing is that...
At least officially.
Officially, yeah. I know that. And then it's like...
Well, it was Max Warburg who sent Lenin in, right? Max Warburg sent Lenin in.
Yeah.
And it was Schiff and Paul Warburg, his brother, who sent Trotsky in.
Well, exactly. You see, and this is the thing, is that they wouldn't be introducing this bacillus for the idea of, helping the population. The Politburo that came to exist was obviously there to oversee genocide. That's what it did. That's what it was.
That's very interesting. I was reading an article by Kerry Bolton about Stalin. And Stalin, how he became a nationalist. These characters, these things may not be completely controlled. The people may go off script, and then the elite, they have to improvise in these things. But his theory was that at the heart of the Trotsky-Lenin, the Trotsky-Stalin conflict, and was that Stalin was a national Bolshevist and Trotsky was an international communist. And he wanted to spread worldwide revolution, and Stalin wasn't really into that. He wanted to more or less build his dictatorship at home. And this is why Stalin rejected the Marshall Plan funding in 1945, 46, and also rejected the plans for the World Bank and IMF. He's opposing, at this point, the Soviet Union is now opposing the New World Order, the Anglo,
right.
Yeah. And so well, he's sort of an accidental opponent of these plans. And that was interesting because Stalin at home, and for the court, particularly during the war, reverted to rather conservative domestic policies. One thing is he stopped abortion in Russia, which enraged Trotsky. He wanted to rebuild the family in these things. There's sort of this propaganda, strong families. And not, he's also his exportation of religion once the Germans invaded in these things. And this was an anathema to people like Trotsky. And this feeds into the sort of, today's neocons are Trotskyites. Internationalists. Yeah. I thought it was very interesting. I don't know if I agree with that, but it's an interesting, again, these are complex relationships, and I can see how, it can go that way, how sort of this internal, just like after World War II, if you look at the ruling elite in the United States, sort of the CFR crowd, there was a dullish pro-fascist Nazi faction, for lack of a better word, versus an Alger Hiss communist faction. And this outing of Alger Hiss was more or less the Dulles faction beating the communist faction of the World Order and setting up kind of their plan, meaning suggesting that even within the CFR, into the inner circle of the CFR and these things, there's some ideological or some conflict between which direction to go. And we can see that played out in some of these.
It's
interesting. I don't know. It's just interesting.
Yeah, they don't invite us to the parties, though, we may get one in the future. But in the meantime, we can only use analytic, approaches to the stuff. But see, from my kind of the way I look at these things, what I see with Stalin is I see the portraits of him with the hidden hand. They got like a million of these.
Yeah.
I see him stealing the terror bomb. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see him rejecting the World Bank. So suddenly he sets up like a way to starve out the population.
Yeah.
And I just think that looks to me like that's all orchestrated. And then supposedly he's anti-Semitic because he has this problem with Trotsky. But, I go, well, if that was the case, how come he had three wives? They were all Jews.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem very anti-Semitic to me. And his third wife, Rosa Kaganov, the witch, whatever, I can't pronounce it, but she was the sister of Lazar. He was the Jew who was running the Soviet industry. He was like a gigantic, European.
Was he also one of the chief executioners in the Ukraine?
Yeah, exactly. He was like one of the guys who was setting up the whole Gulag thing. And so, I certainly would be shocked if there was complete smooth, everyone was, but so there had to have been some conflict. But overall, it's sort of like...
It's Russia, Germany. These are, geographical and geopolitical realities. The German people exist as an entity of the culture. Same with the Russian people. And this the existence of these peoples, possessing a certain piece of land, a certain geographic area, represent a stumbling block to the objectives of the New World Order, the Anglo Atlanticist Anglo Zio Empire, if you want to call it that. But this, you can see this like in the objectives of the British Empire, which was Masonic, Judeo Masonic in the final analysis. But this the existence of a strong, independent Germany and a developing Russia, perhaps working together, would be a stumbling block to the plans of the Atlanticist powers. So what do? You destabilize. You destabilize it by giving Germany, creating conditions where they get their Führer or where they get their dear leader Stalin. And at the same time, and why these men hold these positions of power, you still have the reality of the Russian people, of orthodoxy. You still have the reality of German identity, and you got to destroy that identity. And so these leaders, although they may be controlled to a large degree, still have to play the political card there. And so that's why you see what's going on in Russia, like in the Ukraine, and NGOs are going in there trying to push all the debased culture of the West under the guise of freedom, or you have the psychological decapitation of Germany in World War II, particularly with the Holocaust narrative and these, and the destruction of these historical cities, destroying the Christian culture of Germany and these things, destroying its identity. And now the Germans are the most guilt-ridden, psychologically decapitated people in the world, and they can be endlessly looted and extorted for money because of this. And so there you have, you know, NATO was what? To keep Germany down and keep Russia out. That was NATO's plan. Well, that was in the context of the Cold War. Yeah, but really, what you really see that is keep Germany down, Russia out. Well, that's the Mackinder Doctrine applied just to modern circumstances with NATO. Yeah. And then we see it now with NATO expanding when its chief adversary went the way of the dodo 27 years ago, right?
I mean, well, now they have to fight terrorism.
Yeah, now they're fighting terrorism and, I don't know, doing whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting you were talking about, you know, like the kind of how impotent like the German people are.
Yeah.
I saw a very impotent political class recently, last weekend. The white male in San Francisco.
The white straight male.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, you have to make that characterization because we actually got to see some you know, some demonstrations and whatnot. And not many like sort of ethnically proud, you know, kind of white male guys that would be on their way to fatherhood and any kind of political power. I don't see much of that. I'm not sure what you see in San Francisco. It's the multiculturalism basically has blurred the entire aspect of humanity from the population. They're just weird. You have technologic zombies staring into iPhones and you know, homeless people basically in just states of depravity. And there just isn't, well, you know, I'm a skeptic and a critic, but I didn't see a lot of humanity there in that city. I think, if that's the future, it's, well.
Well, that's part of the, again, maybe a side effect of the Cold War, because, you know, with the threat of nuclear terror, annihilation, you know, thermonuclear warfare, what's the point of being a virile, strong male who can defend himself and his family?
Exactly. And see, you look, books like On the Beach from Mason Nigel Schutte or something, he's just a piece of junk. And so, you know, you put out On the Beach and it's about how everyone dies. Mm-hmm. Radiation comes and wipes them all out. And what's the psychological effect of this piece of culture? Mm-hmm. You know, what strength comes to the population? Well, we're going to fight tremendously against nuclear war. And where does that go? That goes into, well, we need a strong military and a lot of technology for snooping. You know, so the culture is, you know, you got to just watch it all the time. And you need to be very, very skeptical of the whole thing, because it looks to me like it's just one giant system of slavery production and then genocide. So, you know, I, for one, am not happy with this. And I would love to see a class of people emerge that have awareness, you know, of really what's going on. And I think this is happening. But then have some way of communicating with one another and developing a cultural organization and cultural resistance to all this, you know.
Yeah, there's a piece that I read, I've read rather, by Mark Hackard. It was about Kim Philby and the betrayal of the West.
Yeah.
And if you bear with me, let me just quote this. This is
sure.
That Philby and Anthony Blunt, another of the Cambridge Five and surveyor of the King's Pictures, were knighted before their treachery was exposed by MI5 is forgivable, but they themselves were symptoms of a deeper affliction. Chivalry in our age, like every other worthy of value, has been systematically subjected to the logic of inversion. How else do we explain noble titles granted to the masters of usury, purveyors of anti-culture, and dissolute rock stars? And what of Sir Jimmy Savile, BBC disc jockey and famous confidant to the royal family, who for decades perpetrated rapes against countless children throughout Britain, or the several dozens of MPs and government officials who are now only now being implicated in organized pedophilia and child murder rings? Far beyond spying, wickedness of this sort bears directly the stamp of the satanic. Would that God awaken Arthur and his knights to sweep away such filth from England's green and pleasant land? Cold Warrior to the end, Philby staked out his own duplicitous role in the bipolar confrontation between capitalism and communism. It largely unbeknownst to the rank-and-file soldiers of either side, the planned outcome of this dialectical clash was universal tyranny. Just as the Marxists appealed to the inevitability of history, so the plutocratic Western superclass, quite openly through theoreticians from H.G. Wells, Aldous Huxley, to Bertrand Russell and Zbigniew Brzezinski, have trumpeted the supremacy of science to justify their will to power. The technocratic world state, the madman's dream of threatening transmutation into our reality, would make the Soviet project seem as childish play-acting in comparison. Kim Philby was doubtless a traitor. Levels above him, criminals former grandiose, have been engineering the annihilation of the family, national and religious heritage, and the very essence of human identity. Herein lies the greatest betrayal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that the question is, of course, to what extent it was just there was orchestration of both sides of this dialectic. Mm-hmm. And I think that, when he says we ended up in the same place in a way, as the Soviet system in terms of our political and our, yeah, I totally agree with that. I just don't think that that was sort of ironic. I think that was 100% the plan from the very beginning. The West just had, following the war, we just had the capacity for technology production. And so the idea was that here is where wealth would be. For what purpose? To slave technology. That's why the U.S. was made into this, the bastion of wealth and freedom, And now when you see, the corporations, that are like Google and Amazon that are just becoming components of a slave state, you can see how, hey, wait, this is, it's all planned. It's all very, organized. And so the question is, okay, I agree with this guy, and I certainly agree with the perspective that you've been laying out. And the question is what to do about it. What do you think, Tim? What would be like good sort of political hygiene for Americans to engage in with this knowledge? How do we use this effectively to, have a more effective democracy?
Well, I think immediately any immediate political activism or electoral politics isn't the answer. Maybe something local, you can affect some change. But you have to start taking back the culture. That's is sort of trying to break this Faustian deal that we make with technology. And that means just not being so addicted to the little slave devices, not getting our kids addicted to them, and breaking away from the media and the cultural programming. It's mass communication. I mean, that's another study is the Cold War also brought in the scientific study. Well, actually, predates it. Yeah, and I think you've done some research with the Princeton Radio Project and War of the Worlds broadcast.
Mass observation, the British, Tavistock kind of stuff that were before World War II and World War One. Yeah,
and so that's mass communication and television. Geez, for Pete's sake, look what television did to the culture. And it reached saturation point in what 1960, and so just an awareness that these are sort of diabolical devices, and it's cutting off on them. We're just not being so dependent upon them, and hopefully changing the culture. Have children. I know it's tough.
Well said. Yeah,
it's tough because the both male and female don't seem to be getting along too well, and everything in the culture, or at least in the media, seems to try to aggravate those differences and make both of them irreconcilable, incompatible.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. And then remember, we have had a 60% reduction in sperm count in the last 40 years. 60%. I mean, this is, techno-genocide.
Yeah.
And the media does nothing to alert people about this. So, I think that to me, it's like 100%. I would agree with every single thing you said. I would say take really good care of your health. Make sure that you're not poisoning yourself. You avoid toxicity. And just be aware of the general poison so that you're mentally and physically strong. You're strong enough to fight, right? And then after that, it's you know, I've said this a number of times, like a scratchy record, but don't be intimidated when the possibility for, you know, a subject discussion comes up, enter into it. I'm you know, a good example of it, and of course I'm completely ostracized and have no social life as a result. But I mean, it has been a complete disaster. But I have my dignity and simply no acquaintances. But in the future, other people, if enough of us stay this route and stay real with this, then it will become more able to discuss this stuff. And then ideas like the government was in back of 911, a secret society of crypto Masonic, you know, nature runs the government. It's these people are puppets, you know, because it's like, you know, when people are interested in things like the Kavanaugh, you know, debacle or the films about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, man, you can't get them to focus on anything that's real, you see?
Well, it's about as real as, you know, Tom Brady's deflated football, right?
It is. I mean, you know, that, you know, you've mentioned this before, and I absolutely agree with you. We're looking at a football game.
Yeah.
It's just, it has the same reality as, you know, the you know, a football game. So get your head out of all of that. I'm very proud, even though I was caught up, physically caught up in an anti-Kavanaugh demonstration. I was actually on the street and was swept up in it, that I really didn't have the slightest idea that he'd actually been elected, because I just don't see it. My goal is every day is I try to see if how much of mainstream media I can avoid. I just don't participate. I think it's not good for my head. So I'm very careful even about the internet, about what I you know, let into my mind. I do as much research as I can. I read a lot, but I am careful about, you know, who I let, you know, communicate ideas to me. And then I try to be as aggressive as I can when I think I have a reasonable thought or, you know, point that's, I try to get it out. That's why, you know, like, our show is just such a physical pleasure for me. I know a lot of times I seem like I'm demented, but actually it is a great pleasure to talk like this, because it's just, these are the real ideas that are inside of me, you know, and these are not ideas you can express in normal conversation. You can not be intimidated and enter into conversation, but you don't really find, you know, the conversations are awkward. This doesn't mean you can avoid them. You should not only avoid them, you should seek them out. Be bold, because this is how we can start breaking down the intimidation. We need millions of people who want to talk about these things and just won't be shut up.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's a willingness to actually spend a little time thinking about it, actually reading instead of watching, you know, television or you know, trash entertainment and these things. And that's just, yeah, the moment you start exercising that, you develop a longer attention span and develop greater capacity for critical thought.
Absolutely. And, you know,
and also you find yourself just not craving popular culture anymore. You know, it's almost like junk food. You stop eating it and you stop craving it.
Have you been, like, catching these national alert things that they're sending out now, like on the iPhones? Here in California, it's like they use earthquake as one of the things. So you get the entire iPhone network gets a, you know, like a earthquake is about to happen, you know. And this just reminded me so much of the duck and cover.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
well, it's the same thing, you know, we talked about as the Cold War wound down, we don't have duck and cover, but now we have drills for active shooter. In school,
yeah, we have active shooters. We have terrorism, you know, which is just so ludicrous. But it's what we have to keep us, you know, demanding a more effective police state.
Well, just the odds you'd have a drill for something so unlikely, when, you know, it's obviously it's designed to terrorize. It's ridiculous. It's one of these things where, you know, you're far more likely to get run over by the school buses dropping you off.
And you know, and what is the psychological effect of these things? You know, the idea that, well, we've done these drills to prevent, you know, like, so the kids will behave properly during an automatic weapon assault. Right. But okay, so if there is an automatic weapon, you know, like this is great that we train them to, quote, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or something, you know. But so we've had these drills, and but you know, my point is, I don't really think the drills are going to save many people, but I do think they mess with the minds of the 100% of the people who participate in them, you know. And so this is an example of why you just, you know, the public schools are, we've talked about this. It's another one of the slave state components, you know, that you got to avoid.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's another thing is kind of withdrawing from the school system. Even the, yeah. We've talked about college and these things and these, predatory lending debt creating machines and,
well, yeah, and the colleges are cesspools. I mean, the
turn into debt burdened sex robots, more or less.
Yeah, they're like cultural Marxist, racism awareness centers. You know, I have had this like long standing feud with Bart Erdman. I don't know if you know who he is. He's like a Jesus scholar. He's kind of a nationally known, but he's just a pathetic kind of wannabe intellectual, and so. He talks smack about my theory, and so I've been trying to arrange a debate with him. You know, we'd have a debate about this, and so I had to try to get a hold of him at one point. And he teaches at the University of North Carolina, and I was trying to send him an email, which I did, and it just as a digression. And so I said, okay, let's have a debate, and he said, sure. And so he passed me on to this woman who wanted me to send her $10,000 for an appearance fee for this guy, you know. So this is kind of silly. But anyway, I'm sorry to be long-winded. My point is, so I was looking, he's at UNC, and I was looking, and I was going down, where is this guy? Where's his email address? He's talking smack about my theory. I got to get a hold of this guy. So I went to the religious studies department. Tim, if you ever want to see a cultural Marxist cesspool, go to the religious studies department. I mean, every person is like, you know, it's like bi-gender transvestitism. You know, wait a second, what happened to like people who like want to talk about the New Testament?
Yeah,
I mean, it's just incredible. There's you know, like post-Marxist feminism, how, I mean, it just there was just a complete capitulation of sort of normal human beings to cultural Marxists and the entire department, you know. Mm-hmm. So my point is, it's like I'm just getting less and less interested to participate in any way with academia. It just looks to me like it is, you know, it's a slave camp thing with a lot of cultural Marxists. There's not really, I think, more and more of the what you'd call the independent scholar is going to be, you know, hopefully predominant in our culture, because there is just, you know, and this started in the Cold War, where they started to rubber stamp the minds of all of the people who were in positions of academia. And now,
yeah, research funding and all that was all military.
Yeah, when I was looking at this, I was going, good God, this is just, it's incredible. You know, there's nothing, there's not even any religious studies left in the religious studies department. It's become just an annex of cultural Marxism.
Yeah, it's all part of weaponized anthropology, which is
100%, you know. So, you know, anyway, so I'm this is yet another area that I want to like be away from, you know, and try to create a different structure. Anyway, Tim, long show. Thank you so much, brother.
Okay, great. Let you go and have a nice weekend. And we'll talk.
It's been a great show, and I enjoyed it. And next week it'll even be more fun. So have a great week. See ya.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Thank you.